Shalom, and thank you for listening at BethEmmanuel.org. 26 Answers to 26 Reasons is a live recording of a midweek class conducted by Pastor Lancaster in 2009 to answer common anti-missionary objections to the gospel. The class purchased and used Asher Norman's book, 26 Reasons Why Jews Don't Believe in Jesus, as a textbook for discussion. This book is available from Feldheim Publishers, copyright 2007. You can join the class by listening along as we defend Messianic Judaism and the claims of the New Testament. To support Beth Emmanuel in this important work, click on the support button at BethEmmanuel.org.
Well, we're going to be ambitious because they're short ones, so we should be able to do two of them. We'll do reason number 18 and reason number 19. All right, so reason number 18 is dealing with the birth narratives, and reason number 19 is dealing with the names of the disciples. And we're going to be seeing a lot of these types of things where we're trying to, Asher Norman will be trying to point out contradictions in the gospel text to us in order to undermine the credibility of the gospels. And so this is why it was important for us last week to talk about the origin of the Gospels and come to a little bit better understanding of where the Gospels come from, what the Gospels are, and why there would be discrepancies in the Gospels, and why we could expect discrepancies. So, last week, consider last week's lesson a preface to the next several that we're going to be covering. And tonight, we'll start with this birth narrative thing. So he says, reason number 18 is that Matthew and Luke's birth narratives are contradictory. One would expect the earliest accounts to have the most information about historical events, not the latter accounts. The lack of birth or infancy narratives in Mark and John. So there is no infancy narrative in Mark or John, and Mark is considered to be the first of the synoptic gospels. In Mark, a lack of infancy narratives in Mark and John, and lack of consistent narratives in Matthew and Luke, raised the question of whether anything concrete was really known about Jesus' birth and childhood. And so now, we're going to go through a list of contradictions. So we understand that what we're doing here, we understand that in Mark, there is no birth narrative. Mark starts around the time of, Mark starts with the preaching of John the Baptist, right? So Matthew and Luke, we remember from last week, Matthew and Luke, synoptic scholars think that Matthew and Luke had Mark in front of them as they were creating their Gospels. But then they also had another source in front of them called Q, which is the material they share in common. But then they also have additional sources that they don't share in common. So this might be, what are these additional sources? They may be written sources. They may be oral traditions that they've picked up and are transmitting from the apostolic community. So what we're alleging here is that there is no birth narrative in Mark. Therefore, Matthew and Luke made theirs up. And the reason that we can prove that they made theirs up is because they disagree. All right. Okay, let's see how much they disagree, because they do. We'll start out here. When Mary conceived, was she married? Luke 1:27 says she was not. Matthew 1:19 says she was. All right, this is not true. So you can just forget about this one. Matthew 1:19 does not say she was married. It refers to Joseph as her husband and him wanting to divorce her. Remember this? If you understand the way that Jewish betrothal works, a betrothal is not a marriage, but a betrothal needs to be, if a betrothal is to be canceled, it requires a legal written divorce.
But he would know that.
And he does, and he points that out, sort of. He brings it up. But he, like, doesn't... I mean, he really does. It's so strange. He brought it up, And but he acted like that was even more evidence. Yes.
Indeed.
Right. So he says her husband had in mind to divorce her quietly. All right. So then he says, the betrothal mentioned in Luke was the erusin, that's the Hebrew or Aramaic, giving the wife something of value in the presence of witnesses to betroth her. In first century Judaism, the erusin ceremony was about a year before the nisuin ceremony, the marriage. During this year, Jewish couples usually did not cohabitate, although they were legally married, and the laws of adultery fully applied. Correct. Is usually a year in those days, whereas nowadays it's usually about 3 minutes. Really, because that's how we do it now. We do the betrothal just before the wedding, like as a part of the wedding ceremony. So yeah, people had to wait a lot longer then. So this is troubling to me because he poses a question and then answers it himself. I just. Not good legal practice. Number two, Nazareth or Bethlehem? Here's the discrepancy. Luke says that they live in Nazareth. So in Luke, they live in Nazareth, right? Matthew has them in Bethlehem, moving to Nazareth later. Have you noticed this before? All right, well, let's just look at the passages. Luke chapter 1. We can do this rather quickly. So if you look in Luke 1, 27, well, 26. Now in the sixth month, the angel Gabriel was sent from God to a city in the Galilee called Nazareth, right? To a virgin. And she's living there, okay? So that's the verse. That's the verse. She's living in Nazareth. She's in Nazareth. And then if you pop over to Luke 2, verse 4, it says, Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the city of Nazareth, to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and family of David. So, according to Luke, the young couple lives in Nazareth, but they go to Bethlehem. And that's where the birth happens, right? Okay, great. Now, what does Matthew say? Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, the Magi from the east arrived in Jerusalem saying, where is he, right? And so where do they find him? In Bethlehem. They're living in Bethlehem, not Nazareth. And so we don't find them going to Nazareth until after Egypt. Thank you. Yes. So in 2:16, for example, we find that we're still in Nazareth. And then, still in Bethlehem. And then in 2:23, it says, that's when he goes to Nazareth. So, there's your discrepancy. That Matthew has him living in Nazareth, going up to Bethlehem, and then back to Nazareth, whereas Matthew has them only moving to Nazareth after the return from Egypt. It is not a real problem because you can easily harmonize it. Just a quick harmony would be this. And this is how I would suggest it, but I'm sure there's other ways to do it. I would say that Joseph, and probably Miriam as well, are from Bethlehem originally. Their family is in Bethlehem because they're a Davidic family. And that's Davidic territory. So Bethlehem is Davidic holdings. They move to Nazareth. I even think I know why they would have moved to Nazareth. But we can talk about that some other time. But politics forced the Davidic families out of Bethlehem. They colonize some towns up in the Galilee, one of them being Nazareth. However, they still have property and ties and holdings back in Bethlehem. So they move to Nazareth. They're coming to Bethlehem. At the time of the birth, they're back in Bethlehem. They stay in Bethlehem a little while. They end up heading to Egypt. Maybe they stay in Bethlehem a couple of years. It doesn't really matter. But they end up heading to Egypt after they've been in Egypt for a while, for a year or so. They're going to head back to Bethlehem. They find out about Archelaus, as it says in Matthew, ruling in the place of his father Herod. They decide it's too dangerous in Bethlehem still. And so they go back to Nazareth. So it's like having two locations that you can operate out of. But that would be an easy harmony. There's one flaw. And that's reason number five, point number five here, where it says, how long did they remain in Bethlehem? According to Matthew 2:16, they were there possibly a couple years. According to Luke chapter 2, verse 39, it says, when they had performed everything according to the Torah of the Lord, and here we are 40 days after the birth, right? This is 40 days later. After they had performed everything according to the Torah of the Lord, they returned to Galilee, to their own city, Nazareth. So there you have a strong contradiction. In Matthew, they are fleeing from Bethlehem to Egypt and then back to Nazareth. In Luke, there's no flight to Egypt. They go up to the temple and then head back to Nazareth. So, yeah, it's a contradiction. Matthew says they go from Bethlehem to Egypt to Nazareth. Okay? Luke has them go from Nazareth to Bethlehem back to Nazareth. And he has them do it in quick succession so that they're heading back to Nazareth 40 days after the birth of the Master. So the contradiction comes, there's no time for them to still be in Bethlehem, the Magi, the slaughter of the innocents, the trip to Egypt, then coming back, then saying, oh, Bethlehem's too hot, we need to go to Nazareth within that 40-day span.
And where do we get those 40 days?
From Luke. It's the purification. She's going up for her purification. So look, they're obviously different stories. You don't have the Egypt incident in Luke. It's just not there. You have it in Matthew. It's not a problem. Matthew has this tradition about the flight to Egypt, the slaughter of the innocents. Luke does not have that tradition. Are they mutually exclusive? No. This is exactly what we should be doing. We should be sitting and spinning Gemara to reconcile this and coming up with different theories of how this happened and how it comes about. And when Luke says, then they returned to Nazareth, that certainly can be taken in a broad sense. We could take that in a very broad sense and say, yeah, eventually they return to Nazareth because his narrative needs them back in Nazareth, because the next thing he's going to tell us about is pilgrimage from Nazareth back to Jerusalem. So, he's got to move the narrative forward. That doesn't mean that he knew that as soon as they left the temple after Miriam's purification, that they said, well, let's get on the donkey and head back for Nazareth. It's just a narrative element. Sometimes we put too much stress. It's not an irreconcilable contradiction.
Witnesses don't necessarily give the same account.
Right. Well, I'm not.
If they were witnesses.
I don't know. I'm just not alarmed. Okay, discrepancies in the Gospels. Heads up. If discrepancies in the Gospels alarm you, this is not going to be good. They just don't alarm me. It's not a worrisome thing for me that Matthew said this and Luke said that. I don't get it. Do you get it? Why it's such a big deal? I don't get it.
Well, you get it if it's a big deal. If you've been told all your life that the scriptures are inerrant, infallible, and if it's inerrant and infallible, then that means there cannot be anything different in them.
I don't think that's different, though.
I don't know.
A contradiction cannot.
We have lots of real contradictions. This one, not so much, we don't worry about. This one can be harmonized. But there are dead-on contradictions that are irreconcilable between the Gospels. And, so inerrant, infallible? Well, Matthew's inerrant and infallible, and Luke's inerrant and infallible. But they're both inerrant and infallible in their own respective gospels.
Torah long enough, and you have an understanding of there not being problems. Just like the sages look into the Torah and they see these things as well. But for people who are not
as yeah, I understand.
It's going to be very difficult.
So I would sit in Midrash classes. And we would hit these like explosions. You know, these explosive moments where it's like, no, that's wrong. No, that's wrong. Wrong. You know, and they'd be like, no, it's okay, it's okay. There's 70 facets to Torah. There's 70 facets to the gem of Torah. You know, and it's like, oh, okay. Well, it's just a different facet. But it's not, I'm picking on Asher Norman just because we're doing his book.
Yeah.
This is the anti-missionary tactic in general. All right, so number three. How and to whom did the angel appear? Luke 2:15 versus Matthew 2:13. How and don't look this up. This is just stupid. Luke 2:15 is the angels appearing to the shepherds. Matthew 2:13 is the angel appearing to Joseph. It's not a discrepancy. Was there a Roman census? Luke 2:2, Matthew 2:23, according to Luke 2:2. Well, this is getting important. Luke chapter 2, start in verse 1, really. Now, in those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that a census should be taken of all the inhabited earth. This was the first census taken while Quirinius was governor of Syria. And everyone was on his way to register for the census, each to his own city. Joseph also went up from Galilee, from the city of Nazareth to Judea, to the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was one of the house and family of David, in order to register, along with Mary, who was engaged to him and was with child. Okay, so this is the story of the census, well-known story of the census, right? Number, was there a census? He says, yes. Luke 2:2, that's why they went to Bethlehem. And then Matthew says, no, they were already living in Bethlehem. The wise men from the east came, and that's Matthew 2:1. And then he says Matthew's problem was to get them to Nazareth to fulfill the Nazarene prophecy. Number five, how long did they remain in Bethlehem? We already looked at that one. Number six, was Mary required to travel to Jerusalem to register for a census by Roman law? And he quotes a scholar that says women were exempt from the census. And so it's like, well, you know, women were exempt from a Roman census. Women weren't counted in a Roman census. It was. It's also true regarding a Jewish census. You know, the half shekel tax, right?
Yeah.
That it was just Shabbat Shekelim last week. So it doesn't say that Mary had to travel there, though. Joseph was the one who had to travel, right? Mary came with him. Miriam came with him. Mm-hmm. Was Joseph required to register for a census by Roman law? He says Roman census applied only to Roman provinces. Luke's Joseph and Mary lived in Nazareth, which was not located in a Roman province. It was an independent kingdom. Sorry about all the typos. There's late, ruled by Herod. Therefore, there was no reason for Joseph to register in Nazareth. Further, a Roman census only applied to those who owned property in that city, and Luke's Joseph and Mary owned no property in Bethlehem, which is why they slept in a manger. It's a kingdom. He's right. It is a kingdom. Even at this time, it's Herod's kingdom. It's Herod's kingdom. But Herod is a Roman puppet king. Did they own property in... Yes, Luke tells us that that's why they're heading there, because he's from the house of David. I mean, that's something that you would have to know, just that house of David. Oh, Bethlehem, house of... You know, that's the city of the house of David. So, obviously he owned property there. Otherwise, he has no reason to be going there. Mm-hmm. He's not living there, but he owns property there. Now, it's possible to own property and still have no place to stay. Exactly. Property, owning property might be a field. It was under Roman supervision. No, it is an independent kingdom.
Yes.
But the king who's been independently put there has been put there by Rome. It's been a Roman possession, so to speak, since Antipater's day, Herod's father. It gets more interesting, so hang on. In what year was Jesus born? This is interesting. Finally, this is interesting. Okay. A, no later than 4 BC. Why? Because Herod dies in 4 BC. And what do we know from Matthew? From Matthew, we know that he was born before the death of Herod, right? Luke, however, begins by saying, the narrative begins in Luke 2, now in those days a decree went out from Caesar Augustus that a census be taken of all the inhabited earth. And so it's this census. And this census is a historical event. I have it right here in Josephus. It started a revolt, actually, in Judea. So you can read about this. Now Quirinius, a Roman senator who had gone through the magistracies and who had passed through them till he had been consul, and one who on other accounts was of great dignity, came at this time into Syria with a few others, being sent by Caesar to be a judge of that nation and take account of their substance. This is right after Archelaus's. I won't read you the whole passage, but it's here you go. If you want to write it down, Antiquities 18, chapter 1.
I have that book.
Oh, you have this one.
Yes.
476. 476. Six Common Era. That's a problem. That is a problem. That's a 10-year problem. That's a big problem. And this is one that we have seen, even the church fathers were angst about this problem, because this was just a matter of Roman history. This is known. This is an anachronism, like as if I told you guys he was born before Kennedy was assassinated. He was born during the Carter administration. This becomes a real trick for people. So how do you reconcile this one? Well, on the one hand, maybe you don't. Maybe you just say Matthew has a tradition that he was born in Herod's day. Luke has a tradition that he was born after Archelaus's day, during Quirinius's day. So what would that look like? Well, Luke never does mention Herod in the birth narratives, does he? So that's a possibility. That's a real possibility, that Matthew has one tradition on it, Luke has another tradition on it. Another way to reconcile it, people, and this is an old one, to say that Quirinius actually had two terms as governor over Syria. There's the one we know about from Josephus, and then there's one we don't know about that we only know about from Luke, and he had done an earlier census. This seems almost impossible to me. It doesn't work that he would have be able to do a census over Herod's kingdom, or that as a governor of neighboring Syria that he would be like able to impose a census. There's no historical record of it. There's no vacancy in the governorship of Syria for him to sit in right there, and the census started a revolt. As a kind of a big deal. His census started a revolt. So you'd think Josephus would mention that one too. So I can't go with that, but that's one way that it's often reconciled.
Josephus, when did he live?
He's contemporary with the apostles, and he saw the destruction of Jerusalem. So what are you going to do with this one? Well,
if you take his death and you go back, where does it put him?
Well, we don't know how old he was when he died. That's the problem. Luke tells us at the beginning of the narratives that he was about 30 years old. But that's like 30-something. Luke says he was 30-something, basically, is how he puts that. Aaron Eby has the best presentation on the age of the Master. He can prove to you what year the Master is born. 2 years back from the death of Herod. So he says that the Master was born 2 years before the death of Herod, which actually makes sense.
Yeah,
with the whole Egypt thing and also the slaughter of the innocents. Aaron does this based on astronomy, the star. But mostly, he finds like the astronomical event in 6 BC. The sages have this very clear tradition, derived from the chronologies of, and genealogies of the Torah, that Isaac was 36 years old at the time of the Akedah, at the time of his binding. And so that would make, if the Master died in 30 Common Era and was born in 6 BC, he would have been 36. I like that very much. But we don't really know. I mean, the Church Fathers, Irenaeus Irenaeus says he was in his 50s when he died. This is a real problem. There's just no way to not admit that, as Asher Norman says, this is a monumental and irreconcilable contradiction. Could Jesus have been born both at the time of King Herod and at the time of the census of Quirinius? No. However, I have another commentary. This is from a critical set of commentaries. Critical enough. This is the one. These are the Word Biblical commentaries that we have on the shelves back here. Yep. So he goes through these issues with us. And he says, now it is possible to translate Luke 2:2 in a manner that obviates any need for seeking an earlier governorship of Quirinius. Well represented in the history of the discussion, it has been argued most carefully by Lagrange, another scholar, and has been taken up in several more recent studies, and he gives us all the recent studies. Lagrange has shown that there is no decisive objection from word order or from the use of the genitive participle to translating Luke 2:2 as this registration happened before Quirinius became governor of Syria. As a clarifying aside, such a statement would fit well. The governorship of Quirinius was an important turning point in Judean history, marking as it did the annexation of Judea, which was profoundly visible by the census registration with which Quirinius's governorship began. And I told you, it started a revolution in those days. So, it would actually make good sense, as Luke, as a careful historian, to say there was a census in those days. Oh, no, it wasn't that census. It wasn't the census in the days of Quirinius. This happened before the census in the days of Quirinius. This is something that happened earlier. So something that Herod could have been participating with Augustus.
And he said that's in the Greek, that it could be translated.
The Greek before. Can be read as before. Yes. That this happened before. Instead of this was the first census taken while Quirinius was governor of Syria, it could be read as this was before the census taken while Quirinius was governor of Syria. I like that. If we accept that reading of the Greek, that would go into the category of there is no difficulty here. I like that a lot. Okay. The conclusion, his conclusion, these conflicts and contradictions in Matthew's and Luke's birth and infancy narratives are monumental and irreconcilable and profoundly undermine the credibility of both Gospels. Yeah, I wouldn't go that far. I'd say there's definitely a different version of the story in Matthew and in Luke. Okay. Reason number 19. The Gospels do not agree about the names of the 12 disciples. Well, this happens to be a favorite topic of mine. I printed out the little chart. If everybody picked up the little chart, I printed out the chart that he printed in the book here. But first, we'll be using that chart in a minute. Matthew and John, he says, the Gospels of Matthew and John. In these Gospels, Jesus picks up his disciples one, two, several at a time in different places. Jesus' followers were one or two of his brothers, several individuals from his hometown in Galilee, and several individuals Jesus took from John the Baptist. And he gives us a series of citations. Matthew 4:18, 21, 8:19, John 1:37, 40, 43. In Mark and Luke, Jesus' disciples are all chosen together at the same time. Luke 6:12 to 13, Mark 3:13 to 14. All right, this is just factually wrong. This is absolutely wrong, what he's saying here. In Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the disciples are picked up a little at a time, a little at a time. That's in John, they're picked up a little at a time. He's taking different parts of the narrative and saying, look, this is a contradiction. Let me explain. You've got the story of The master's walking along the Sea of Galilee. We were talking about this last week. He sees two disciples. Come follow me. They come follow him. He sees a tax collector. Come follow me. They come follow him. And so we get this story. He's picking up disciples. It's getting bigger. You know, the group's getting bigger, right? Then we find these over in Luke 6 and in Mark 3. It says he goes up into the hills. He prays all night. Then he comes to figure out who's going to be the 12 disciples. He comes down and he chooses the 12. And so, bang, all at once, he selects the disciples all at once. This is not a discrepancy. He had way more than 12 disciples. He had, at one point, 70 disciples. At the time he enters Jerusalem in the triumphal entry, he has you know, probably hundreds of disciples. At one point, we saw 5,000 people surrounding him. You know, so the fact that he picked these disciples up slowly, and then at a later time picked 12 to be the inner circle, is not a discrepancy whatsoever. All right. Did Matthew know his own name? Okay. So, Matthew chapter 9, verse 9. As Jesus went on from there, he saw a man called Matthew sitting in the tax collector's booth, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he got up and he followed him. But if you read the story in Mark chapter 2, verse 14, what do you read? As he passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting in the tax booth, and he said to him, "Follow me." And he got up and followed him. So in Mark, his name is Levi. In Matthew, his name is Matthew. So, number one, there's a discrepancy in the name of the tax collector. Number two, Asher Norman points out, if Matthew was writing this, why doesn't he say, "I was sitting in the tax collector's booth, and he said, 'Follow me,' and I got up and followed him"? Well, that's silly. For one thing, Matthew's not writing this. Matthew wrote the Hebrew Matthew. This is the Greek, who knows how many generations removed, like we talked about last week. This is not the pen of Matthew. Matthew didn't write in Greek. So this is put together from sources, like we learned, from Mark, from Q, etc. It's attached to the Matthew tradition, the Matthew documentary tradition. But it's not handwritten by Matthew. Secondly, even if it was handwritten by Matthew, that would just be bad form. I don't know what the point of that was. But what about this problem with this, he has two different names. He's Matthew, or is he Levi, the son of Alphaeus? This is a problem. There's two possible ways to reconcile this problem. One is that he's a Levite. So he's called... We'll find that all the disciples pick up nicknames. As I wrote about this, about why do all the disciples have nicknames? There's two reasons all the disciples have nicknames. One, a lot of them had the same first name. And I don't know if you've ever had this experience, like where you worked on a crew with a bunch of guys, and there's two Daves, maybe, or two Johns, or something like that, right? And so then you differentiate with nicknames. So we find that a lot of the disciples had same first names, which is normal in the first century Judaism. There's a very narrow bandwidth of nomenclature, it seems. We know that from ossuaries. There's just everybody seems to have the same names. You know, just how it is in Ireland, where every little girl is Mary something. Every little girl is Miriam something, you know. That's why there's so many Marys in the Gospels. The other reason that they all have nicknames is, and this also goes back to like guys that spend way too much time together. When guys spend way too much time together, they rename each other. That's a normal part of human life. And so here we've got guys that spent 3 years, you know, bopping around together, and they renamed each other. So it's possible that the Levite is the nickname for Matthew. the Levite.
A conclusion on that, the fact that the Gospel of Matthew claimed that Jesus chose Matthew rather than saying he chose me suggests that Matthew is not the author. The contradiction with Mark demonstrates a devastating lack of credibility. Now, we're going to start to see, as his arguments weaken, his adjectives increase. So, a devastating lack of credibility right there. You know, that's Paul's list is problematic. Paul's list of disciples, did you know Paul had a list of disciples? Well, in 1 Corinthians 15, when he's relating the resurrection appearances, what does he say? You don't have to turn there. He says, he appeared first to Cephas and then to the 12.
Oh, yeah.
That makes 13 disciples. So the Gospels have 12 disciples. Paul knew of 13 disciples because he numbers Cephas outside of the 12. Well, actually, if you do the math, at the time of the resurrection appearances, the 12 were 11 in the first place. They're called the 12 collectively. You know, they're just called the 12 because they're the 12 disciples, even if they're not 12. So it's just a way of saying the rest of the 12. The rest of the remaining 12 would be what he's saying. What were the names of the 12? Now is when he gets out this list to show us that there's devastating discrepancies in the list. And so there's some specific ones he wants us to look at. First of all, line number 6. Nathanael is a disciple in John, but not in the Synoptics or Acts. Okay, first of all, John never gives us the list of 12 disciples. John just randomly tells us about disciples here and there, but he never gives us a list of 12 names like these other sources do. So Nathanael is not necessarily even one of the 12. Nathanael could be outside the 12. He could be one of the 70. There's nothing to indicate that Nathanael is one of the 12. But what's really funny is to look at this line of information. He's called John. In John, he's called Nathanael. And in Mark, he's called Bartholomew and all the rest. What's hilarious about that is that Nathanael is a first name, Bartholomew is a last name. That's just Bartolomei. Bartolomei, perhaps, or Bartolomei. You know, Nathanael Bartolomei is... I don't know, I just find that one amusing. Okay, next one. Disciples Jesus loved is present in John, as you know. The disciple Jesus loved, he's the anonymous disciple in John. But does not exist in the three synoptic gospels by name. So he finds that James the son of Alphaeus is also never mentioned in John. So he makes an equation between James the son of Alphaeus and the disciple Jesus loved. I've never heard that before. That's an interesting theory, but I don't think it's correct at all. But why is that even a problem? I don't know. Thaddeus in Mark and Matthew, but not Luke, John, or Acts. So find the Thaddeus line. Okay, line 10. Look at this. You've got a disciple named Thaddeus in Mark, and in Matthew, he's called Labius, surnamed Thaddeus. But in Luke and Acts, he's called Judas, the son of James. And in John, he's called Judas, the son of Simon. He is not. I'll come back to that point in a minute. Forget about the John reference there. Okay, but you see the discrepancy? Thaddeus, Judas, Labius, surnamed Thaddeus. This is not a problem. Judas is his real name. That's his Hebrew name. The problem is you have two other guys named Jude, two other guys named Yehuda. And so we're going to have to somehow tell these Yehudas apart. So how are we going to do it? One of them is nicknamed Toma, the twin, Thomas. So Thomas, we know this from extra-biblical literature, his name is also Yehuda. So that's why they called him the nickname, twin, Thomas. Yehuda, the son of James, Judas, the son of James, is nicknamed Thaddeus and Lavius. Two different languages. One is Aramaic. Lavius, it's Levi, heart, hearted one, okay? Like your lave. Whereas Thaddeus is, I believe, Aramaic. It's for a nursing baby. A nursing child. So both of what these two names have in common is they're both terms of endearment. They're like what you would call a little kid, you know, like, oh, Thaddeus, to die, you know, to die. And Lavius is the same. He was the youngest disciple. He's a son of one of the other disciples. He's the son of James. He's probably a teenager. He's like the teenage disciple. And we also happen to know that his, from another reference in the gospel, that his grandmother was traveling with them. So I always like to picture it like this. You know, it's like, she's always like, come here, cutiekins, you know, she's like that. And the other disciples are going, cutiekins. And so he gets stuck with these nicknames. But it's not, there's no contradiction here that he's called Thaddeus, Judas, and Lavius. I mean, look, even in Matthew, it tells us that he's Lavius, surnamed Thaddeus. Okay.
What about Judas, son of Simon?
Yeah, next one. Judas, son of Simon. Judas, son of Simon. He's never called Judas, son of Simon. Judas, son of Simon is not is not Judas, the son of James. But first we've got to go to line number 12. In line number 12, our lawyer makes the case. He says, the second mention of Judas is called Judas Iscariot. Judas Iscariot, right? In all of these lists, that's the second Judas mentioned. But the second Judas mentioned in John, and there is no list in John, is Judas not Iscariot. And so this is a contradiction between Judas Iscariot, but John calls him Judas not Iscariot. That's not true. John doesn't call him Judas not Iscariot. John calls Judas Iscariot, he calls him Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. So Judas, the son of Simon, is Judas Iscariot. So the one that he put in number 10, according to John, you can look this up, that's John 6:71, he even cites the verse. John 6:71, Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot. That one belongs down here in line 12. And Judas, the one called not Iscariot, belongs in line 10 with Thaddeus, Judas son of James, Judas son of James, Lavius surnamed Thaddeus. So, what you have here is an intentional attempt to obfuscate and confuse, I think, either that or he really confused himself.
That's possible.
It's possible. Yeah. But he makes a case out of it. He says, there are two Judases in John and Luke, but only one Judas in Synoptics. Second Judas in John is called not Iscariot. Second Judas in Luke, and only Judas in Mark and Matthew was characterized as Iscariot. So he tries to make some sort of point out of this. I don't know. My point is that there's no point to be made. Anyway, so there's your list of what are the names of the 12 disciples. The conclusion that he comes to, I just put on your sheet as wild speculation. He writes, the Gospels name James and Judas as two of Jesus' brothers. That's true. Those are also names of Jesus' brothers. And then he goes and says, but they're the same James and Judas here. Which doesn't make sense because here, Judas is the son of James. They can't be brothers and father and son. Anyway, Acts alleges that Jesus' brother James took over the Jesus movement. This James may be called maybe the second James, referred to as James the son of Alphaeus. The Gospels may have hidden the fact that he was Jesus' brother to minimize his importance as long as possible because James opposed the theology of Paul. See, that's what I mean by wild speculation. This is spinning off nowhere. Significantly, James, the son of Alphaeus, is absent from John's gospel. Why is that significant? It's not. This is ridiculous. Anyway, it goes on for quite a ways like that. The inconsistency in the names of the disciples undermine the credibility of Jesus' story is the final conclusion. And that's the end of reason number 19. All right, it's serious. This is the kind of stuff. This is the kind of... people are losing their faith over this kind of stuff. Because why? You know, like we mentioned earlier, it's this strict inerrancy thing. That's, I think, the biggest problem. Bart Ehrman of Misquoting Jesus, he tells his story at the beginning of that book, Misquoting Jesus, and he shows all, you know, textual variants and that sort of thing. He about how he was an evangelical, strict guy, inerrancy of the Bible guy. You know, there can absolutely be no... And he had that whole theory. And I remember hearing this, like, from a pastor when I was a kid. If there's one word of it that's wrong, the whole thing is wrong, sort of thing. You know? But that's a house of cards. You know, you built this house of cards. You find one word, one thing, one tiny thing.
But we don't even have the original text.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a whole other question. That's the dodge. You can hold inerrancy and say in the original manuscripts. You know, absolutely. But Ehrman, you know, he went to seminary, started to learn. Whoa, what's all this? And he became very good at Greek, and he's doing textual criticism and that sort of thing. And it destroyed his faith. So you know, he's no longer a believer. Now he writes books trying to convince other people not to be believers too. But I thought it was a very good, you know, that story was a very good example of what happens to people if they're not educated in a faith construct.